I think the answer to that is that the startup world is the complete opposite of, you know, what they teach you in business school. And this is so ironic. So not only did I used to be an academic, but I used to teach MBA classes actually. And I can tell you the way startups are run are, you know, it is basically 180 degrees the opposite of what people usually teach in business schools, right? Like in business school, it's all about, you know, having something that's set in stone, making sure you plan everything in advance. You have very clear strategy. It's all about profitability, you know, EBITDA positive and things of that nature. It's targeted at the corporate world. In startups, you don't even have certainty of what's gonna happen tomorrow, right? You live day by day, sort of. So I think it's very challenging for me because I'm not used to that, and I'm basically doing the exact opposite of what I've been preaching for a few years.
Hey, this episode is brought to you by Slice. Slice is a creator management solution that brings content creators, agencies, brands, and talent managers together to better facilitate long-term relationships for brand sponsorship deals. Ooh, that's a mouthful, but essentially what we're trying to do is help content creators go full-time. And the best way that we think to do that right now is helping them get more brand deals, right? Get more money. The problem is that process is very manual right now, and it takes a lot of work, and it, you know, dissuades people from using content creators in their marketing, right? So our platform simplifies all this, adds data, makes it easy for everyone, right? So go check us out, slice.id. Content creators, it's free for you. Agencies, we're a SaaS platform, but I have a deal for you. Use my promo code CEO100, and I'm going to give you 100% off for 3 months. Yeah, that's a lot, but you know what? I want you to try it out. I want you to do a campaign, run a report fully automated with our APIs, and see how much time you save, right? A report's take two weeks. Ours take 12 hours. I should know that faster than that. And you know, we can do campaign lists. You know, usually that takes 5 days for agencies to pull up for brands. Ours are done in 5 minutes, right? Because all of our content creators connect their accounts, Instagram, YouTube. So we get historical data. They give us their rate card so we can automatically calculate their cost per reach, cost per engagement. We're just faster, right? So stop with the spreadsheets. Go give Slice a try. Use my promo code CEO100, slice.id. If you have any questions, just send me personally an email, jesse@slice.id, and I will get you sorted out. All right, on to the episode. Hey, welcome back to the Side Door Podcast. It's been a minute. A lot has happened since I last recorded one of these. Most notably, I quit my job at Mindshare, right? So no more cushy agency life. I started a company, Slice. You heard my ad read. Clearly need some work, but you know, live and learn. I've been busy just, you know, raising money from venture capitalists, building the company, building the product, talking to customers, recruiting people to work for our company, right? So I've been really busy. I haven't had time for this podcast, right? So now we're starting to hire more people. I can take a little bit more off my plate. So now I have some time. I'm gonna start recording these again because you know what? I miss it. I love it. And you know, I'm running a company for content creators, and so it's good to have my finger on the pulse and create content and see. So you know, we're experimenting. You can see we have some video now. We're gonna see how this works. We're gonna try out some softwares to see you know which one is the best. If you know if we should even use video. I don't know. It's an experiment. It's fun. So learn, grow with me, bear with me. Thank you. So today we have a really good episode, right? So getting back into the saddle, learning, you know, basically relearning how to interview people, especially like with video, it's totally different than audio only. So we got Dr. Timothy Astandu from Populix. Populix is a market research company, and they basically help people find out, you know, the questions that they need to know for their business. Market research is typically reserved for the larger companies. You know, working with Unilever, they definitely spend a lot of money on market research. But you know, the SMEs of the world, they don't have the time or the money for it, right? So it's usually like a couple Google searches, and that's about it, right? So Populix helps by connecting through their app brands, companies with real real people, real users, for surveys, for questionnaires, for testing, to get, you know, a good idea of what is like the reality of their product, their comms, their ideas, whatever it may be, right? So Tim and I have a very good conversation, right? So learning about Populix, and really learning about like his background, right? He comes from academia, similar to Eka from TannyHub, right? So they were academics and then they transitioned to entrepreneurship, right? So very interesting path. Wanted to learn more about that. Market research, again, one of those things that seems a little bit boring, but incredibly useful, especially from like me, you know, coming from marketing. So very insightful conversation. Hope you enjoy it. And welcome back to the pod. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jesse. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So you are the co-founder and CEO of Populix. Will you start off by just kind of letting everybody know what Populix is?
Yeah, sure. So Populix is a startup in the market research space. What we do, we're basically a consumer insights platform that help any businesses ask any questions that they want to ask. So whether it's I want to open a new branch, or is my menu appealing to people, or even basic questions like who are my competitors and things of that nature, we help them ask those questions. And we have a pool of 300,000 respondents spread across Indonesia in all primary, secondary, tertiary cities. And we connect the businesses with these respondents. So these respondents are authentic and they give their genuine answers to help these businesses make strategic decisions based on the opinions and insight they get from the respondents.
Got it. Right. So I'm a marketer, so I have a lot more questions about this. But before we dive into Populix specifically, maybe let's start and talk about your background and like kind of how did you get to starting Populix?
Yeah, a lot of people ask me this question because I think it's not an industry or a startup that most people would start. It's actually quite niche. And for me, I got into research like a long time ago. So by fate, I think my life led to Populix. So my background was actually in academia. Prior to joining Populix, I spent a lot of time in the UK and in Europe. At first, I was just studying there, then I did a PhD, and then after I did my PhD, luck would have it that I met a professor who taught me a lot of things about research, and then, you know, it led to me becoming an academic. While I was doing my PhD, I met Eileen, and Eileen is the COO and co-founder of Populix. So she was actually one of the students and I was marking her essays. But in one of those nights in Cambridge, because there are, you know, not so many Indonesians actually, we were drinking in a basement pub and we were like, you know, just talking nonsense like, oh, okay, what are you going to do when you go back home to Indonesia? And interestingly, she was actually interested in research because she worked in a consumer goods company. And if you've ever drink, maybe I shouldn't say the brand, but if you go to Indonesian supermarkets and you go to the shelf, you'll find Eileen's drink still there to this day. And so she understands research from like the client side, the demand side, right? Whereas as an academic, I understood research from the supply side. And so we connected and we're like, yeah, this is a good idea. There are so many amazing startups in the UK, in Europe, and in North America doing amazing, and they're focusing on market research. Maybe this is something we should implement back home. Since, you know, Indonesia traditionally, and to this day actually, does very slow research actually. It's like dinosaur way of doing research. And then we reconnected like 2-3 years after that. And again, by fate, by serendipity, Eileen just quit her consumer goods job. I also was looking for a way back home. And then, we decided to build Populix. We joined an accelerator program and then we realized, you know, we actually needed a CTO to build our ideas. Eileen and me, you know, we know nothing about technology. Again, as luck would have it, we met Jonathan, who was working in a similar startup in the US, very successful, and was looking for a way back home because he's getting married to an Indonesian and he's Indonesian too. So he became our CTO. And that's pretty much the story of how Jonah, Aileen, and Tim met and built Populix. And this was way back in 2018, I think.
Got it. Wow, that's very cool. Starting out with academia. So you had mentioned that the way that Indonesian companies are doing it right now, or before you started, was like, you know, very archaic, right? You know, like dinosaurs. So can you describe what that process or how they these companies were approaching research?
Yeah, they think of research as something that you must do manually. And I think that's one of the big issues. So, if you imagine an interviewer trying to intercept shoppers at a supermarket cashier, giving them 200 questions out of a list on pen and paper, that is how people traditionally view research in Indonesia. I can give an example, and this is a real case example from one of our clients. They're an automotive brand. They would actually hire people to stand in parking lots next to the cars they're interested in. And they would wait until the driver comes back to the car and like, oh, I waited 2 hours for you. Now I need to ask some questions. And obviously you can, this is an extreme example, but you can imagine the inefficiency and ineffectiveness of doing research this way. So, it's a very traditional way of collecting data. And I think, now with the advent of big data, the advent of apps, everyone is on their mobile phones. There surely must be more efficient ways to collect data. And I think that's the innovation we're trying to do at Populix.
So then, can you explain to me your solution, right? Like, how are you automating this? How are you bringing technology into this to make it a much faster process?
Yeah. So first and foremost, we're very focused on the mobile phone app because I think Indonesians are super sticky to their mobile phones. You cannot even force people to do surveys on laptops. I know it worked in developed countries, but maybe not in developing countries. So our solution is to do all sorts of data collection, whether it's simple surveys, whether it's product testing, whether it's diary entry studies, whether it's qualitative interviews. Everything has to be able to be conducted via the mobile app. And I think that's our main focus. We want to be there in the phones of everyone who can give insights. And I think because of this, we are able to do research much faster than the traditional competitors. And the reasoning is simple, right? We already have the pool of respondents. It's like whenever we need to grill a fish, instead of going to the lake or like fishing them, we already have an aquarium and I can see which fishes I want to eat today. So that's the analogy I like to give. And in terms of cost, it's much cheaper as well, right? Because if you have to go fishing whenever you need something, it's expensive. But at the same time, if you already have everything in front of you, the financial cost is much cheaper. And finally, it's much more accurate also, we feel, because once we collect all the data via the mobile app, we actually control so much of the parameters. We know how many clicks, we know the average time it takes for someone to complete a survey and things like that. And we can really control it end to end. Even when the respondents register, there are a lot of KYC or know your customer questions we ask. We need to know their information. We make sure that they're authentic, they don't have duplicate accounts at Populix. And we actually have a credit scoring system for respondent authenticity, even like this is the extent we care about data quality. So based on past answers, we can actually predict how honest a respondent, truly is.
Okay, so let me just so we everyone understands. You have a mobile app, right? And so you have over the years acquired a large pool of everyday people, right? And so let's just say 100,000 people. And then I am Coca-Cola, right? And I say we're launching Coca-Cola Light, right? And we want to know is this the right branding, or is this the right flavor, whatnot, whatever the survey question is. So then they put out the parameters, right, on your app, and then you guys essentially will find the 1,000 people that they want to talk to, fill out the survey, and then they get the information that they want. Is that essentially like the process?
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely spot on. And not only can they, blast it very quickly because we already have the pool of respondents, the drink brand can actually choose who they want to target. Is it, young millennials? Do they live in urban areas? Do they have to like a particular genre of music? All these screenings we already have in our screening system on the respondent side. And that allows us to really target an ideal audience for a particular study.
So then, how are you acquiring these users? And then, like, what is the information that you're getting? Because it sounds like you're asking them a lot of like qualifying questions.
Yeah, so we do it organically actually. So by word of mouth and people, download our app. We brand ourselves as a lifestyle app. So there are actually a lot of fun activities you can play on the app. It's not just surveys because I think the moment we fail to gamify the app, then people will leave the app in groups actually. So that's why we want to make it fun. There's actually like a family feud type game on the app. You can fill in personality quizzes, you can read articles. You can win monthly prizes as well. You can win a PS5, you can win a lunch date with a famous artist and things like that. So we gamify to make sure that people are interested because they do have to reveal a lot about themselves in terms of the qualifying questions that you mentioned. And the algorithm I mentioned earlier about this credit scoring system, it's important to ask these qualifying questions because our algorithm will actually calculate the honesty based on these qualifying questions. So let's say, you're age 27, but you still go to high school and you own a Mercedes-Benz. This will trigger like red flags on our system, right? Because it doesn't make sense. You're 27, why are you still in high school? If you're in high school, you don't have a license to drive a car. And so, by answering or by asking rather all these questions beforehand, we can actually build the persona around a particular person and know how realistic that is.
Okay, so you gamified the system, right? So it's very similar to like what BuzzFeed does. BuzzFeed had all those quizzes, which are essentially give them like targeting information for advertisers, right? Was this part of the original product, or did you kind of like build this, have like kind of almost like the marketplace, and then realize you needed to make the consumer side a little bit stickier? Or like, how did you figure out that you needed to bring all those extra elements to it?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing we realized was when we realized that in Indonesia, people's mobile phones are very, rudimentary. So they don't have a lot of space and you have to compete with the likes of Facebook, WhatsApp, all these other apps. So if you don't have a very appealing app, they would simply uninstall your app. And I think that was the biggest lesson for us. The moment we realize these people are uninstalling because they think, oh, we're just a survey app. The moment the survey runs out, I'm not gonna get anything out of this app anymore. I'm gonna delete it so I can download a different app. So this creates a challenge for us in which how can we stay relevant inside someone's phone? How can we be interesting for them so that they will actually open our app every day and think of us as an essential app? And that sort of like situation caused us to really focus on gamifying and making sure that, this is a very interesting app and you should be very sticky when using this app.
Got it. So you were obviously you're trying to make it stickier, but you're making it fun and you're getting all this data. And do they realize that they're giving you, volunteering this information to them, or are they just having fun with your app?
I think they and we're very transparent about this actually. The moment you download an app, we actually give a disclaimer saying that we are a data collection app, and your opinions will be used for market research. And I think for us, we have to be able to do both, right? Make sure that they're aware that their data is being used for market research, but at the same time, they do so knowingly in a fun way. With the app and the games and everything like that. And I think that's also one of our differentiator towards the competition. People like to give insights when they know we're being transparent, and people generally dislike if their data is being collected, clandestinely and basically, it's the app is for a different thing, but you're collecting all sorts of different data, then people will complain.
So, customer acquisition is the lifeblood of any company, especially for an early stage startup, and it's really freaking hard. So, depending on the type of company, you're going to use different channels, and just because you get people to sign up doesn't mean that they're going to like stick around and use it for a long term, right? So, customer acquisition is kind of like a multifaceted process. So, obviously, it's something that I'm going through right now with varying degrees of success, and again, market research. How do you keep these people who are giving you the vital information that help the companies that are paying you to stick around to use the app to just take more than one survey? So this is really important. So I wanted to ask Tim about it, and he had some really good, interesting answers on customer acquisition, retention, and kind of like how they use the gamification to make their app stickier for all of the testers, I guess, the testers, users of the Populix app.
When you said you acquire these customers organically, right? What is the carrot that you're using to acquire them? Is it that they can get paid to take a survey and then the games afterwards are what keep them around? Is that how you do it?
Yeah, I think there are explicit and implicit rewards. Explicit rewards, we give definitely the monthly lucky drop prizes, the rewards they give for doing a particular study or trying a new product. And the implicit rewards is the games and also the satisfaction of, you know, influencing the everyday products that they use. I think a lot of people out there, you know, they want to see them, their opinions be heard, right? And if you can see, you know, oh, today I voted for this movie poster. And then like next month when you see the movie come out and it's actually the poster you voted for, you feel happy because you actually influenced that decision. So that's kind of like the implicit messaging, implicit rewards messaging that we try to communicate to the respondents as well. Not only are they getting, you know, financial rewards, but they're actually making a difference.
How much are they, you know, I guess it's going to range depending on the client, right? But how much would a typical survey or product test or whatever, how much could they potentially make? Like, what's that range look like?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the project, like you mentioned, right? So let's say if you're trying a particular product and you need to review this product for a month, that's gonna give you a lot of rewards because it's so time and effort consuming. So that might be like $200. But for very simple surveys, you know, that takes a click, then that's like 10, 20 cents, right? But I would say the average, let's say for a simple survey, that's quite, you know, the norm would be in the range of a few dollars per survey.
Got it. So some of your campaigns can last for an extended period of time.
Yeah. So I think people try to consider us as like a useful side job in a way, rather than playing games and spending your money on buying game credits, right? When you sit during your daily commute, you could actually make a few bucks. You're not gonna make a living out of doing surveys. I think, you know, everyone realizes that. But if you can get, you know, an extra $50, $60 every few months, I think people find it useful.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for some people, they have to understand that that's a lot of money for Indonesians outside of Jakarta, right? You can feed a small family for, you know, that $1 or $2 that you're talking about, right? So for, you know, if you're in Singapore, US, maybe it seems not worth it. But for a lot of Indonesians, that is substantial income, especially if it's on the side.
Definitely.
So then, okay. What kind of companies are you working with then, right? That, you know, you had talked about FMCG. I think you talked about automotive. You talked about like entertainment, but like, who are the type of companies that are coming to you? How big are they, right? What is your sweet spot right now?
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, everyone in this space usually targets the really big companies, but for us, it's a bit different. I think our mission, you know, literally, this is the Populix mission and vision. We have a tagline that's written in all of the employee handbooks saying that our mission and our vision is to create a world full of good business decisions. We've done our job if all the businesses in the world rely on data to make good business decisions. And this means that we need to expand our clients, not only from these super huge multinational companies, but even SMEs. When people have business ideas, they want to open their small coffee shop. They need to rely on data to make these business decisions, not just, you know, their instincts like, I think it's going to be good here. I'll just open a shop here, you know. So because of this, I think our client split is 50-50. 50% the big companies, multinationals, every brand you see in the supermarket, banks, automotive, insurance companies, you can imagine, you know, the kind of companies. And then the other half, the latter part, is actually first-time research buyers. So this would be your SMEs, your startups, people who basically just got funding and needed to know where the market is. We also get a lot of university students. We also get a lot of individual users who are entrepreneurial and trying to figure out some business questions regarding their, you know, side hustles. So it's quite interesting because we can see that, you know, up to half of Populix customers are actually first-time research buyers. And of course, you know, in terms of revenue, it's a much different split, right? Like, you know, the big companies obviously chunk in a lot more revenue. But in terms of users, I think we've sort of succeeded in our mission of opening research towards people who never thought they would be able to do research. And these people actually don't understand research at all. It's just because our app is very friendly and we help people who have very layman knowledge of research do sophisticated research using our app.
So you said it's split 50-50 roughly, but the SMEs, right? So the SMEs, they're typically less sophisticated in many areas of business, right? And do you struggle communicating the value, or how do they know that they need research for their marketing, for their product, or like what is that like sales process, onboarding process like?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. We also struggled like literally almost a year figuring that message out, but I think we found what the holy grail of the answer is. Actually, it's basically the bottom line. The, you know, they don't understand this complicated research language. They don't care about, oh, data, what's the standard deviation, what's the level of significance. They don't understand that. But if you tell them, hey, this impacts your bottom line by plus 12%, if you change your messaging by XYZ, you will expect blah 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 increase in your top line, for example. And they love that, I think. So SMEs, you know, they understand numbers, right? They don't understand all the sophisticated research stuff. But if you can make an impact on their bottom line, you can make an impact on how much revenue they earn, giving them better margins of, or even, you know, a lot of SMEs now, they spend money on social media ads, right? It's something that's big. You'll see a lot of people spending money on Instagram and TikTok ads. Why is that? It's because they feel it will make an impact on their business. It will grow their business. So we give them something very similar also. We tell them, well, one of our research tools that can help you is to maximize, you know, who you spend it with and things like that. Do you really need it right now? Who, which channels you should do? And you know, things of that nature, I feel. So as long as you can help SMEs improve their bottom line and think of research as an investment rather than as a cost, then they will be very open to it.
Got it. Everybody loves money. So I guess going back to the consumer side, right? Like, one thing, as you were talking about, you're talking about like, the smaller businesses, you know, this could just be me, right? But I get caught up in like Jakarta, right? Everything evolves around Jakarta, right? But Indonesia is a very big country, you know, fourth largest population. Many, many different islands, which have different, you know, kind of regional tastes and cultures. So how do you make sure that you have, you know, representation in all of these areas, including the much, you know, smaller, I think you said, you know, second and third tier cities?
Yeah, I think it's important to note a few things first. You know, Jakarta is obviously the most important part of Indonesia, right? You know, I might be overgeneralizing here, but, you know, up to half of consumption in the entire Indonesia is in Jakarta. And at the same time, if you look at the population and you think of people who actually have money and who have disposable income, it's probably only around 40, 50 million maximum out of our population of 200, 300 million people. And where they live, they obviously live in Jakarta and Java. So in on one hand, I think it's very important to really focus on Jakarta. And that's why the bulk of our respondents actually is in Java. But then when you look at the prospects, where the economy is going to grow, where do you see the fastest you know, economic development and things like that, then you see all these outer islands doing, you know, growing at a very rapid pace. So, you know, the easy way is to focus on half in Jakarta, but then you also have to focus on the other half outside Jakarta. And that's kind of like our mindset when we think about the business. And that actually is reflected in our pool of respondents. Because at the end of the day, we only create this pool if the businesses want to ask questions to these respondents, right? So if you see our pool of respondents, most of them will be in Java and Jakarta. But at the same time, in every island, we'll have like several smaller but very pools. So for example, in every major island, there's a big city in Sulawesi, it's Makassar. Bali is obviously big. In Kalimantan, there's Balikpapan. And in Sumatra, there's Palembang and Medan. So these are our focus areas there.
So one thing I think I'm going to be asking a lot of guests this year, and Tim is, you know, no difference, is kind of like how they've grown, how they've adjusted, learned from, you know, managing, you know, as their company has grown, every different stage, you know, founder, CEO, at the seed, the pre-seed, Series A, B, C. These are all like different responsibilities. What do they need to be focusing on, right? And so for me, someone in the seed stage who has a very small team, you know, my responsibilities are a lot more hands-on. I'm not just managing, I'm like doing a lot of the things. So curious how, you know, when Populix just raised $7.7 million, so that gives them more ammo to hire more people, kind of like start to expand, really work on that product roadmap that they have. So, you know, I'm very curious on like what that means for Tim as a CEO, as a leader, and then, you know, kind of like how that has affected him in his abilities, you know. And so, yeah, I think this is something, a reoccurring theme that we'll see in these podcasts. But yeah, I think Tim has some really good insights after recently raising their Series A round.
So I guess I kind of want to shift gears a little. So you guys recently raised $7.7 million Series A round. So
yep.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Now that you have this fresh funding, right? Like, what does the future look like? What do you want to invest in? Like, what is growth, right? Like, are you introducing new products? What are you doing?
Yeah, I think especially with the tech winter coming and, you know, nobody knows how long it's going to last. I think we want to be able to use this money wisely. So we're not going to spend everything, you know, on crazy growth or something like that. It's no longer growth at all costs. But I think there are two key sectors we really want to emphasize and focus on. So first, as you mentioned, is this kind of like version of Populix that is targeted as SMEs. So our SaaS model, and we call it Poplite. And so this Poplite is designed for people who have very basic knowledge of research, but they want to do research and they can get actionable insights immediately. So that developing that product will take time and also will take a lot of money because, you know, nowadays, even engineers are being laid off. They're still expensive. So we need to build our tech team first. And secondly, I think another key sector we want to focus on is to go overseas, perhaps sometime soon. Because I think, you know, what we're really, really good at Populix is basically collecting data via the mobile phone. And as long as there are countries where people of the country are super sticky to their mobile phones, I think, you know, that is a market we want to go to. So I can think of neighboring countries such as the Philippines or Thailand or Vietnam being very interesting for our product market fit. And so we might consider going there in the next few years. I think those two are the major drivers for us and how we're going to use our money. Obviously, we will also expand headcount, and also marketing spend and things like that. Those are also other components that we will use the money for.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, got to be smart at this macro environment. So I wanted to ask, you know, kind of building off of, you just raised around, your company is going to be growing, right? Your background is in academia, right? And so you're a CEO now. And kind of what is something that you have encountered or learned that you didn't even know that you needed to know before starting this company?
I think the answer to that is that the startup world is the complete opposite of, you know, what they teach you in business school. And this is so ironic. So not only did I used to be an academic, but I used to teach MBA classes, actually. And I can tell you the way startups are run are, you know, it is basically 180 degrees the opposite of what people usually teach in business schools, right? Like in the business school, it's all about, you know, having something that's set in stone, making sure you plan everything in advance, you have very clear strategy, it's all about profitability, you know, EBITDA positive and things of that nature. It's targeted at the corporate world. In startups, you don't even have certainty of what's going to happen tomorrow, right? You live day by day, sort of. So I think it's very challenging for me because I'm not used to that. And I'm basically doing the exact opposite of what I've been preaching for a few years. And I think that challenge, yeah, it was quite difficult. But then again, you know, with tech winter, I think the startup world has changed also. So it's getting closer. It's converging toward what I would say, you know, is conventional business sense. So nowadays, you know, people in startups, they're also preaching about profitability. I mean, if you go back 3-4 years ago, no one in startup will say, oh, you have to be profitable in the first few years. Everyone will be just, yeah, you have to grow, you have to expand, and things like that. So things might be coming full circle, although I don't think it will. But at the same time, yeah, it's just been really interesting because I can see sort of like the pros and cons from both sides, from like a very traditional business theory sense, and the pros and cons from like, you know, a very practical startup live day by day kind of thing.
Got it. Yeah, no. Teaching is way different than actually doing it.
Yeah.
So then what is like, what has been one of your biggest challenges as CEO growing Populix to the point it is today?
I think the biggest challenges, the biggest challenge is that there's always so many challenges on a daily basis. So number one, firefighting, I think. I don't know, but you know, in a startup world, like everything moves so fast that you have to basically firefight every day. And there's always going to be things happening in different divisions. So having that ability to literally flick like a switch between thinking about business, then thinking about recruitment, thinking about the next town hall, thinking about the next investor meeting, I think that has been very challenging. Secondly, I think I hinted at this in my previous answer, but about structure, right? Like, you know, business as I understood it before is very structured and things like that. But in startup, you have to be flexible and you have to be able to do things on the fly. I think that's you know, perhaps linked with firefighting, but that's the second challenge. And for me, lastly, I think is there's always so many things you can do, like so many paths you can take as a startup, but you have to be focused, right? If you chase everything, then you'll fail at everything. But if you identify, let's say, like 10 areas of growth, but you focus on like 2 or 3 and really have conviction that this is the way forward. And even if things fail, you just take it, you know, and just go march forward. That's not the challenge for me on the, you know, founding a startup, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. That resonates with me tremendously. I guess, you know, context switching, right? It's something that I deal with. I try to figure things out. A lot of, you know, fires to deal with, like you said. Do you have like a framework or how do you approach like prioritizing what you need to work on and what you should be, you know, offloading to a team member?
Yeah, I do that usually the night before or like really early in the morning when I reply to emails, and it's kind of like the first thing I do when the day starts. I figure out like which ones I need to take myself and then which ones I could delegate. I think as like a rule of thumb, if I think that this issue is going to be big or has a problem to be big, then I will take care of it straight away. But if this issue is something that, you know, is more like an operational task, then I will delegate it to someone. And then I also, as a, like, you know, something I do is usually I spare like 2-3 hours in the afternoon empty. So I never book like any time you know, during these particular slots, because something will happen during the day that will require me to actually fix that during those empty slots. So I think, you know, those are my main tactics in firefighting and figuring out which task I should do myself or I should delegate.
Yeah. I don't have those empty slots, but that sounds like a good plan. So, you know, 1 year from now, right? Someone asked me this question. I thought it was really interesting. 1 year from now, you know, you've got all these things that you're working on building. If you and I were to meet for drinks and we're going to toast, right, to a milestone for Populix, what is that thing that you want to toast about?
Okay. I think maybe not 1 year from now, but, you know, 1 or 2 years is probably Series B. I think, you know, as a startup, it's always good to think about the growth of a company in terms of your fundraising, because at the end of the day, whenever you raise a round, it means you manage to convince investors that you're doing a good job. You're growing well, I think. And you know, it's sort of like a report card in school, right? When you do this funding round. So I hope that we'll be able to at least, you know, given the environment, maybe not completed our Series B round, but at least be in a position where our growth is doing really well and we are actually ready to be a Series B company. I hope we can toast about that sometime soon.
I hope I can toast that we're a Series A company at that time with you.
We should do it at the same time so we can have the drinks and we'll have something to toast to each other.
You know, you don't need to give me an occasion to drink, so just call me. I'll get you out of here on this one last question, right? So you've been doing this, you know, I'm just starting out. What's one piece of advice you would have for someone who is starting out their first startup?
That's tough. There's like literally 1,000 things I could say on this because, you know, it's such a... Okay, I think because there are so many things I could say, then I guess my main piece of advice would be, you know, it's something that you have to persevere. I think startups are not for people who are faint-hearted. I think there's going to be challenges every day. And you can only succeed if you, you know, really just march on with all the problems that are going on. Like literally the house could be on fire and you just have to stay positive and smile. It's like, I don't know whether you saw, there's a meme with like a house on fire and there's like a dog in front and the dog is just smiling. I think when you run a startup, that's kind of like, especially in day one, you know, that's like day one mentality, right? Fighting fire every day and, oh no, how am I going to overcome this? And then tomorrow, you know, something bigger happens. Oh no, how do I overcome this? I think, you know, that ability to have that mindset and to overcome the challenges in early on and being very perseverant. Yeah, I think that would be the best advice I could give.
That is my favorite gift. And I send that to many, many people. Tim, thank you so much for the time. It was a pleasure having you on the pod. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Side Door Podcast. I hope you liked it. I hope you know, bear with me as we experiment through these things. These voiceovers are a little less scripted than I did in the past. So we'll see how it kind of turns out. I don't even know. But yeah, I really appreciate you listening in, coming back to listen. I know, you know, not recording for a year it is weird. But, you know, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify. You know, share it with your friends. Sidedoor.xyz sends you to our Spotify page. Message me on Instagram at Jesse Bowman or email me jesse@slice.id. If you have any questions, like you want to request someone on the pod or you want to ask me any questions about Slice, more than happy to answer those for you. So anyways, you know, we got some more episodes coming up that I think are really compelling. Always working on that pipeline of guests. Yeah, I mean, just thank you again for listening. And so until next time, stay curious.